The Almagest is the second most important and longest-lasting scientific textbook of all time, after Euclid's Elements. It held sway in the classical, then Arabic, and finally Western European world, until Kepler unravelled the true movements of the wandering planets in 1618. But there is a problem. Whereas Euclid's work is substantially correct, Ptolemy's is not. In his researches in the library, Ptolemy overlooked or ignored the observation by Aristarchus that the sun lies at the center of the solar system, and chose instead a geocentric model. Perhaps to be fair to him, Aristarchus's work may not have been there, destroyed in the fire started by Julius Caesar. Even if it had survived, other great men like Archimedes had dismissed the idea, so Ptolemy can perhaps be forgiven for doing likewise. Instead, using Aristotle's vision, along with data collected by the Babylonians and his illustrious Greek predecessor Hipparchus, as well as with some basic trigonometry, Claudius Ptolemy concocted what was by then a conventional view of the universe, with the Earth static at its center, and the sun, moon, planets, and fixed stars revolving steadily around it. Observing that the planets do not move smoothly across the sky in one direction, but sometimes appear to backtrack, Ptolemy ironed out these eccentricities by introducing the notion of epicycles, little pirouettes the planets performed when they appeared to retreat along their paths. With this system, even previously unobserved erratic planetary behavior could be explained with the addition of a new epicycle or two. The addition of this catchy little device meant that cosmology became stuck in the rut of an Earth-centered universe, a view which became so ingrained that it became pure dogma, to the point where, according to Arthur Koestler, on February the 23rd, 1616, the Church's qualifiers, theological experts, in Rome, gave their decision concerning two propositions put to them. 1. The sun is the center of the world and wholly immovable of local motion. 2. The earth is not the center of the world nor immovable, but moves as a whole also with a diurnal motion. The qualifiers unanimously declared the first proposition to be foolish and absurd, philosophically and formally heretical, inasmuch as it expressly contradicts the doctrine of Holy Scripture in many passages, both in their literal meaning and according to the general interpretation of the fathers and doctors. The second proposition was declared to deserve the like censure in philosophy, and as regards theological truth, to be at least erroneous in faith. Arthur Koestler, The Sleepwalkers. Such was the gag order pinned on Galileo for daring to suggest that Aristarchus, plagiarized by Copernicus, was right, and Claudius Ptolemy, after Aristotle, was wrong. Claudius Ptolemy should not be criticized out of his time, however. The Almagest, a working, functioning model of the universe, creating mathematically based explanations for all the celestial movements, as well as updating and expanding Hipparchus's star catalogue into four figures, was still a stupendous achievement. It may not have been a correct model, but it fitted the observations of the day and provided a usable, working cosmological background to the whole of the Middle Ages. Nor was Ptolemy about to leave the cosmos at that. His follow-up work, the Tetrabiblos, is concerned with the impact which the heavens have upon individual personalities and worldly affairs. That is, astrology. The very mention of the word incites passionate controversy. It did so then, too. But whether we believe in it or not, Ptolemy's Tetrabiblos, containing as it does a great deal of data drawn from Babylonian, ancient Egyptian, and earlier Greek sources, is the seminal work on the subject. The Tetrabiblos has had the longest life of all his works, being studied and employed by contemporary astrologers more than 1,800 years after he set down its basic principles. As astrology, long dismissed as a pseudoscience by many, raises such passionate hackles, it is perhaps worth making some general observations on the subject before going into the details of Ptolemy's formulations. Astrology as we know it probably originated largely in Babylonia, where priestly watchmen studied the movements of the heavenly bodies in great detail and over very long periods of time. Their reputations as magi were widespread and attracted the attention of classical thinkers like Pythagoras. This was, of course, an age of omens, when kings and slaves alike attempted to deal with the often cruel vagaries of life by looking for clues as to what the future might hold. The Magi believed that in their observations of the movements of the stars, they had found a unique method to do just that, to assess the personalities and fates of individuals by considering the positions of the heavenly bodies at the moment of birth, or what is called today natal astrology. Whether or not this connection is true or false, the least we can say about astrology is that it is humanity's first enormous attempt at human psychology. From their observatories, every possible form of human personality trait was projected onto the cosmos, though of course the astrologers argued the other way around. So Mars projected warlike characteristics onto people born under its influence. Love emanated from Venus, and so forth. And here, of course, lies the problem. The scientific skeptic simply has to ask the question, how do the planets and other celestial bodies transmit these qualities to individuals on Earth? Over the millennia, this matter of transmission has essentially been an article of faith, a mystery whose veracity is borne out only by the accuracy of its predictions. Ptolemy's approach to astrology was that it was a conjectural rather than a precise science. So many variable factors had to be taken into account, such as race, country, and local culture, that absolute precision was difficult to achieve. And Ptolemy was also very aware that the subject was plagued by charlatans. As for the nonsense on which many waste their labour, and of which not even a plausible account can be given, this we shall dismiss in favour of the primary natural causes. What, however, admits of prediction we shall investigate, not by means of lots and numbers, of which no reasonable explanation can be given, but merely through the science of the aspects of the stars to the places with which they have familiarity. It is the same with philosophy. We need not abolish it, because there are evident rascals among those that pretend to it. Claudius Ptolemy, Tetrabiblos. While Ptolemy displays no interest in the magical or mystical, or even the symbolic aspects of astrology, he does draw on contemporary scientific thinking, which maintained that planetary characteristics were drawn from this relationship to the sun, where they received heat and light, and the earth, which was the source of moisture. Thus the moon was moist and dark, while Saturn, at the outermost position of all the known planets, was both cold and dark, and therefore thoroughly malevolent, the purveyor of death and destruction. His view was that the constantly changing positions of the celestial bodies created a continually fluctuating atmosphere to which all living creatures must respond. Whether Claudius Ptolemy was right or not concerning astrology, and we should bear in mind that millions of people worldwide consult astrologers every day, as do countless millions of Western newspaper readers, it is his incredibly convincing presentation of the subject which gave his work its longevity. This is how he opens the Tetrabiblos. Of the means of prediction through astronomy, O Cyrus, two are the most important and valid. One, which is first, both in order and in effectiveness, is that whereby we apprehend the aspects of the movements of sun, moon, and stars in relation to each other and to earth, as they occur from time to time. Second is that in which, by means of the natural character of these aspects themselves, we investigate the changes which they bring about in that which they surround. Claudius Ptolemy, Tetrabiblos. With the 13 books of the Almagest and the 4 books of the Tetrabiblos, Ptolemy effectively created a model of the universe and its workings which would dominate the world for more than 1,000 years. Even though we may now consider his work flawed, the fact remains that by all the standards of the time, Ptolemy's universe worked. And though for the most part his language remains couched in the scientific terminology of his day, he is not above occasionally letting us know his inner, spiritual attitude. For while his work was the first attempt to gather and systematize the mechanism by which the universe operates, his universe is not simply mechanical. Occasionally, in his writing, we can feel the inspiration behind his work, the sense of wonder that every astronomer knows and which must first have overwhelmed him when, as a child, he looked up through the clear Alexandrian night sky at the great vault of the heavens above him. I know that I am mortal and ephemeral, but when I scan the multitudinous circling spirals of the stars, no longer do I touch earth with my feet, but sit with Zeus himself, and take my fill of the ambrosial food of the gods. When Ptolemy looked back down to earth, however, he saw another challenge. Having completed his mammoth task on the heavens, he felt, like Socrates before him, It was time to bring his philosophy from the heavens down to earth. That earth began for Ptolemy with Alexandria itself. Here in the markets were people from all over the earth, and piled in the warehouses along the waterfront were exotic goods gathered from as far as any traveller had ever reached. It was in part as a response to this cosmopolitanism that Ptolemy decided that the traders and explorers venturing out from this crossroads of the civilized world, which the Greek orator Dio Chrysostom called the conjunction of the whole world, needed a new guidebook, a book that would take them to the very edges of the known world and perhaps beyond. Ptolemy's geography is composed of 8 books. Its intention was simple, to make and draw an account, an atlas, of the entire known world, and to construct maps which accurately reflected the texts. But as always, before proceeding to the work in hand, it was necessary to review all the existing sources on the subject, evaluate their relative accuracy, and to devise and develop the necessary mathematical techniques for both the written geography and the accompanying cartography. The idea of measuring the world, agreed by then to be spherical in shape, by dividing it into vertical and horizontal lines, had been used by Eratosthenes when he made his astonishingly accurate measurement of the earth's circumference. But it was Ptolemy who developed this idea into the notions of longitude and latitude, divided into degrees and minutes. With this framework established, the next question was how to make the most accurate assessment of the positions of the major cities, rivers, lakes, and mountains of the known world. Ptolemy realized that as winds vary, so the speeds of ships fluctuate. Further variations are caused by the effects of tides and currents, so simply logging times traveled at estimated speeds would not necessarily produce accurate positioning. Similarly, travelers proceeding on foot or horseback rarely traveled in a straight line or at a constant speed. He preferred Eratosthenes' method, measuring the angle of the sun's shadow at midday to estimate where a traveller might be longitudinally. This data he chose to combine with all the known reports from mariners, traders, travellers, and explorers to come up with a list of more than 8,000 localities, each uniquely pinpointed by its own longitude and latitude. His next problem was that of projecting the spherical world, of which he knew that only about half was known, onto a two-dimensional piece of paper, to produce a map. In Book 1 of the Geography, he shows us precisely how he planned to do it, dividing the hemisphere of the known world into 18 meridians of 10 degrees each, the longitudinal lines converging on the North Pole and at their widest at the equator. The remaining task was therefore to transfer the 8,000 plotted locations onto the grid-planned page and fill in the details of the map. Ptolemy's geography was lost from the fall of Alexandria until about AD 1300. When a copy of the great work was found, it was in Arabic, and the world map, the 26 regional maps, and the 67 maps of smaller areas were all missing. But the text was so detailed and comprehensive in explaining how to make the projections onto paper that enthusiastic cartographers found the maps relatively easy to reproduce. What then did they see as they put his world atlas together? The first thing they must have noted was its sheer extent. Stretching from Iceland to China, it really did cover all of the old world. Admittedly, there were several oddities. Much of India was not there, replaced by an enormous version of Sri Lanka named Taprobana, and Africa below Ethiopia appeared to go on indefinitely, as did China as the easternmost point on the map. But most of Europe, North Africa, and the Near and Middle East were much as we see them today. Egypt and the Nile, the details of the Red Sea and Arabia, the Aegean Islands, Cyprus, the leg, high-heeled boot and football of Italy and Sicily, the square box of the Iberian Peninsula, and France, Germany, and Denmark were easily identified. The British Isles grew an interesting extension jutting out from eastern Scotland, but the southwestern limb of the Cornish Peninsula was there, as were Wales, the Isle of Man, and a plausible outline of Ireland. Considering that Ptolemy constructed this map in the late 2nd century AD, and Britain was much more than 1,000 miles away by sea, the accuracy of his work is truly astonishing. Little wonder, then, that Claudius Ptolemy has come to be known not just as the last and perhaps the greatest of the classical astronomers, but as the father of geography, too. Claudius Ptolemy's achievement was to lay out a whole system by which the world, the universe, and indeed the fates of men might be known. In it he hoped to live up to the ideals of Alexandrian philosophy, ideals which had been known to Eratosthenes, Callimachus, and Aristarchus before him. In this, for all its failings, Ptolemy's work was a spectacular success. What he could never have known as he wrote, however, was that his system would provide the framework for a new age, the Christian age, which was already sparking to life in the streets around him. Chapter 14. Dawn of the Iconoclasts. "Now," says Solomon, "defend wisdom, and it will exalt thee, and it will shield thee with a crown of pleasure." Clement of Alexandria, Stromata. For Ptolemy, Philo, and the Alexandrian philosophers in whose footsteps they trod, spiritual enlightenment came from two interconnected sources. It was in the unending search for wisdom which might allow them to see beyond the sordid material world to Plato's. Coupled with this was a personal code by which their bodies and minds might be in a suitable condition to search out such truths. This path was by no means easy, requiring moderation and temperance, a willingness to shun the obvious temptations of the physical world and to strive to find divinity in ideas alone. As such, it was a path suitable only for the chosen few. Neither Philo nor Ptolemy believed that just anyone could enjoy the insights they had received. They were the highest link in the human portion of the great chain of being, with the privilege and perhaps the duty of understanding the world on behalf of lesser humans, the uneducated, the women, and the children. In 2nd century Alexandria, however, a new force was stirring which took a radically different view of man's and woman's destiny. During Ptolemy's lifetime, access to this proto-religion had been largely by word of mouth, with just a few accounts of the life and works of the new man-god in circulation. However, those stories had not died out, as so many other religious tales had, and now, just a century after his crucifixion at the hands of the Roman authorities, tales were rife that the Messiah had emerged among the Jews. His appeal lay partly in the fact that he had renounced the great chain of being. He hadn't said that the poor and downtrodden must accept their place in society, however meek. In fact, he had said the reverse, something radical and dangerous. He had said that the meek were going to inherit the earth. Christianity, as preached by Jesus and passed on by his disciples, was a truly revolutionary doctrine, which, for all its overt pacifism, turn the other cheek, love thine enemies, clearly challenged directly the established social order. In a world dominated by the brute force of the Roman Empire, powered by slavery, awarding most of its inhabitants, particularly women, second-class status at best, the evangelizing zeal of Christianity, preaching damnation for the rich and powerful, and salvation for the meek and oppressed, was almost certain to catch on. The highly publicized persecutions and martyrdoms of its early adherents only added fuel to the fires of this passionate new faith. Alexandria, with its free and tolerant attitude to intellectual debate, as well as its burgeoning population of the downtrodden, slaves, Egyptians, and women from across the known world, was perfectly positioned to become the first great center for Christian study. It would be here that the new teachings would be refined, formalized, and shaped into the first proselytizing religion the world had ever known. This would also be the stage on which Christianity's main opponents voiced their opinions. In the streets, these academic disputes between rich and poor, Jews, Christians, and pagans, would increasingly be fought out not only with words, but with lives. The most penetrating and comprehensive assault on Christianity came from a man named Celsus, who wrote a book titled The True Word, or The True Discourse, around the time of Claudius Ptolemy's death in the mid-170s. It gives us a unique insight into what some of the wealthy and educated ruling classes in Alexandria really thought about this new religion. But also, in the extraordinary story of its survival, the book demonstrates the passions such arguments would arouse and the lengths to which people would go to suppress views that differed from their own. Not a single copy of Celsus's book survives, as every one was ordered destroyed by the Christian Emperor Valentinian III and Archbishop Theodosius in 448. Early Christianity took great pleasure not just in the annihilation of anyone or anything deemed to be pagan, but in wiping out any trace of dissent from its own historical records. Paradoxically, this zeal could sometimes protect the very material that the Church wished destroyed. About 70 years after he wrote it, a copy of Celsus's book was sent to the preeminent Christian theologian of the time, a man named Origen of Alexandria, with a request that he refute it. After some hesitation, Origen consented and wrote his famous treatise Contra Celsus, Against Celsus. This work immediately entered the Christian canon as a revered early defence of the faith, and it has been carefully conserved ever since. But Origen did such a thorough job, he was an Alexandrian scholar after all, that he quoted almost all of Celsus's book verbatim. How else could he refute him, point by point? Indeed, so much did he quote that in the 19th century, scholars were able to reconstruct 90% of the original just from Origen's rebuttal. In this deliciously ironic way, the greatest early onslaught on Christianity was conserved almost word for word in the Church's own sacred annals. We know next to nothing about Celsus as a person, and just as his book itself is a reconstruction, what little we do know of the man himself has had to be reconstructed from that book. For many years it was thought that Celsus must have been a Roman, living in Rome, and hence displaying all the contempt for a foreign peasant religion that we might expect from the then masters of the world. But in his work there are clues to his real origins. His writing clearly shows a deep knowledge of Egyptian customs, something people in Rome had little interest in. His description of Judaism is also unusual for a Roman, not dealing with a Western tradition, but instead speaking of the idea of logos, the word. This is a unique aspect of Oriental Judaism, and one we have heard expressed before by Philo. So all indications are that if we had gone looking for Celsus in the 2nd century, we would have found him not in Rome, but at the museum in Alexandria. His True Word consists of a preface followed by an attack on Christianity, first from a religious, Jewish point of view, then from a philosophical standpoint. This is followed by a detailed refutation of Christian teaching, and an appeal to Christians to renounce their faith and return to the pagan fold of the True Word, Logos. Celsus opens his attack by accusing both Christianity and Judaism of arrogant separatism, in that both claim a special relationship with God as chosen races that casts them as superior to the rest of society. This, Celsus claims, is false. In reality, all peoples share the same relationship with divinity. In fact, he suggests that the evidence of how Christian and Jewish peoples have fared in the world might be taken to imply that God actually was prejudiced against them. The Christians were, after all, a persecuted people, and the Jews still had no homeland. These seemed to Celsus odd rewards for chosen peoples. Turning then to Christ and his teachings, Celsus begins by attempting to set the record straight with regard to the virgin birth, pointing out that there are many examples of divine inseminations of mortals in Greek mythology, which the Christians have crudely copied. He gives his own stark version of what he imagines were the real events. Jesus was born in a certain Jewish village of a poor woman of the country, who gained her substance by spinning, and who was turned out of doors by her husband, a carpenter by trade, because she was convicted of adultery. After being driven away by her husband, and wandering about for a time, she disgracefully gave birth to Jesus, an illegitimate child. Origen, Against Celsus. He then moves on to provide his explanation of how Jesus, from this unpromising beginning, went on, thanks to the superstitious Egyptians, to return to Palestine with a religious mission. Celsus claims he became a servant in Egypt in order to raise money, and there learned some miraculous powers, the sorts of tricks that Egyptians loved and were famous for. He was so pleased with these that when he returned home he declared himself a god. Celsus maintains that on his return, however, Jesus was not able to persuade his fellow countrymen of his divinity, merely attracting a following of 10 or 12 infamous publicans and fishermen, hardly company fitting for a god. Celsus goes on to claim that Jesus failed to keep his promises to the Jews, and even failed to sustain the loyalty of his followers. Of his claims to have predicted his own death, Celsus asserts that this was merely fabricated by his followers, like the story of the resurrection, another trope which appears so often in Greek mythology. If Christ rose from the dead, he asks, why did he show himself only to his disciples, and not to his persecutors? It becomes clear that Jesus does not measure up to Celsus the Platonist's notion of divinity. Using Philo's term logos to mean the executor of God's will, he piles on the sarcasm. The Christians put forth this Jesus not only as the Son of God, but as the very logos, not the pure and holy logos known to the philosophers, mind you, but a new kind of logos, a man who managed to get himself arrested and executed in the most humiliating circumstances. Celsus, On the True Doctrine. Celsus goes on to attack both Christians and Jews even for claiming that theirs are separate religions, when in fact Christianity derives directly from Judaism. His view is that because the Jews revolted against the Egyptians and the Christians against the Jews, sedition lies at the root of both traditions. He complains too of the lack of any cohesion or agreement among the many fledgling Christian cults which were flourishing at the time, claiming that they have almost nothing in common except the name. But it is the way that he has seen Christianity spreading through Alexandria and the Empire that most baffles Celsus. Alexandria is a city of wisdom, where men dedicate their lives to study so that they might understand the true nature of divinity. Study draws men further up the great chain of being, yet Christian evangelists seem to ignore this, shunning the well-educated and concentrating their efforts on the lowliest and most ignorant parts of society. Why is it, Celsus asks, that it is only foolish and low individuals and persons devoid of perception and slaves and women and children of whom teachers of the divine word wish to make converts? For why is it an evil to be educated and to have studied the best opinions and to have both the reality and the appearance of wisdom? Why should it not rather be an assistance and a means by which one might be better able to arrive at the truth? Origen, Against Celsus. His view is that the Christians have added nothing to the wisdom of the ancients, and in fact have often distorted and perverted the tenets of the great classical thinkers. Philosophy, he maintains, clearly distinguishes between true wisdom and mere appearance, whereas the Christians demand that adherents believe what they don't understand and evoke the authority of their discredited leader as endorsement. Even Christ's apparently new doctrine of the resurrection he dismisses as a mere corruption of the ancient doctrine of the transmigration of the soul. This lies at the very heart of Celsus's concern. In his view, rationality, the logic of the museum scholars, is the path to understanding the divine. But Christianity does not require his sort of wisdom. It does not demand that its adherents spend their days in the philosophy lecture halls. Instead, it requires only one thing from them, one thing that anyone of any social standing can give, and the one thing that can really threaten his world order. Faith. In this, Celsus sees a terrifying future, where the knowledge that he stands for counts for nothing, and the dangerous masses might threaten the established social order. Under Christian rule, he believes, the lower classes would rise up, fired not by a new love or understanding of philosophy, but inspired by a blind and unquestioning faith that actually revels in the ignorance of its adherents. With this anti-academic group in control, there would then be no rule of law, and the classical world would be reduced to barbarism. What would follow would be chaos and the end of the world as Celsus knew it. Prophetic words, these, as we shall see as Alexandria's fate unfolds. But Celsus believes he has a cure. Having identified the rotten worm within the apple, he appeals to the Christians to forsake their errant ways and return to the fold of true Platonic paganism. Some commentators consider that this was his intention all along, that his aim was a reconciliation and return to the true path, as is acknowledged in some passages of Origen's rebuttal. Celsus declares that his desire is to help all men and bring them all to the ideal of a single religion. Celsus has done, certainly in his own view, a classic Alexandrian analysis of Christianity and found it wanting. Like so many scholars before him, he gathered the information and sifted and ordered it, before applying the test of his own logic to it. In studying Christianity, which yet had a shortage of texts, Celsus must have spent long hours, not in the library, but in the market, talking to the evangelizing Christians as they sought converts. It must have made for some nervous and heated exchanges, but at the end of the day Celsus still hoped that they would return to the old order. In his mind this new religion was subversive but not yet truly dangerous. In the end, the great chain of being would re-establish itself, so he could afford to treat the Christians he met not as enemies, but more as errant children. They should turn away from thoughts of liberation and return to their established place in society. But Celsus had overlooked one key issue, the issue of faith. At its most fundamental, the debate Celsus raised with the Christians was about the nature of God. In the Platonic world, God was an ultimate form, like Philo's God, a constant creator, but one utterly divorced from the world of people, animals, cities, and wars. To remain in his pure form, God must not have contact with our fallen human world, so by definition a God on earth is a debased God. God is good and beautiful and blessed, and that in the best and most beautiful degree. But if he comes down among men, he must undergo a change from good to evil, from virtue to vice, from happiness to misery, and from best to worst. Who, then, would make such a choice? Origen, against Celsus. But Celsus reached this appreciation of God's nature via the classical Platonic route. His ideas of divinity were to be found through philosophia, the love of wisdom, in which the philosopher refined himself in an attempt to reach closer to God through the purity of his spirit. What Jesus and his followers preached was not philosophia, but credo, belief. Their God was to be found through faith, and faith alone, and no amount of intellectual and spiritual refinement would help the individual on that quest. Both parties agreed that there was a God, but only one party, the Christians, believed that access to the Almighty was open to all and sundry through faith. Even though they may not have felt the benefit until they had shuffled off this mortal coil, Christian converts lived their lives in faith and in hope of a better life thereafter. This appealed to those who could never afford to enroll their children in the encyclia, to people for whom the next life could, in truth, only be better than this one. These ideas, faith and hope, the cornerstones of Christianity, were barely to be glimpsed in the canon of Hellenistic philosophy. Celsus was also making a mistake if he thought that Christianity was something new in Alexandria or just another passing craze. Eusebius, the Greek bishop and ecclesiastical historian, claims that the religion's roots in Alexandria go right back to the apostles. According to him, St. Mark came to Egypt preaching the gospel around 41 to 44 and created a center for discipleship and education in the city, becoming the city's first patriarch. In truth, reconstructing the life of Mark is fraught with difficulty, and the fact that writers like Origen make no mention of him in connection with the city might suggest that placing him there is a later tradition. Even the nature of his death is uncertain. The Acts of Mark claims that the saint was gloriously martyred at Easter in 68 by an angry Alexandrian mob that dragged him to death through the city streets in reprisal for his attempts to turn them away from paganism. This story does not emerge before the 4th century, however, and may simply serve to provide the city with a major martyr. Although these stories may not be contemporary with Mark, they do demonstrate how quickly Christianity gained a foothold in the city, and how even early on its church fathers could associate themselves with a character as powerful as one of the apostles. They also contain a veiled warning of events to come. Whether Christianity was established in Alexandria by St. Mark or by a later disciple, it was certainly firmly rooted by the time of Celsus's denunciation. Indeed, it was about to move out of the marketplace and into its own educational establishment. The dean of this institution, Pantinus, was a brilliant Christian scholar, and the establishment he would preside over, the Didascalia, would go down in history as the first school of Christian religion in the world, and the home of the first translation of the New Testament from Aramaic and Greek into Coptic, the language of the Christian Egyptians. Founded around 180, this school was intended to take on the Platonists at their own game. According to one ancient source, Pantinus was originally a Stoic philosopher himself, and therefore well used to the classical form of education available in the city. This he now applied to the teaching of Christianity, forming a catechetical school, where his faith and other subjects were taught orally by repetition, or by question and answer. Pantinus was a Sicilian, and his greatest pupil, and later friend and successor, was Clement of Alexandria. Clement was probably born and educated in Athens, his Greek is very proper, and so received a full classical education before he converted. After his conversion, he set about finding the greatest Christian teacher in the world, someone who could not just inspire the people of the marketplace, but defend his religion against the relentless logic of the professional philosophers. Eventually he found Pantinus, in perhaps the only city that could have produced such a man, a classically educated convert who could bring Christianity into the same regard as the museum at which he himself had trained. Clement immediately knew his search was over. "Having tracked him out, concealed in Egypt, I found rest. He, the true, the Sicilian bee, gathering the spoil of the flowers of the prophetic and apostolic meadow, engendered in the souls of his hearers a deathless element of knowledge." Clement stayed with Pantinus until 189, when the dean was selected to go on a mission to India, in fact probably southern Arabia, and Clement took his place in the Didascalia. According to Clement, Pantinus eventually returned from India bearing the copy of the Gospel of Matthew in Hebrew, which had originally been carried there by St. Bartholomew, and which was now the treasured possession of the Alexandrian Church. Pantinus was not well rewarded for his trouble, however, and was apparently martyred in 216 in one of the anti-Christian pogroms, which would become a feature of the pagan Roman Empire in that period. The Didascalia had originally been conceived as a specifically Christian school, designed to educate converts to a point where they were ready for baptism, but it was set up in typical Alexandrian style. The school was open to anyone who wanted to learn, not just Christians. Subjects taught there included all the classical greats, not scripture alone, but science, mathematics, physics, chemistry, astronomy, medicine, and music. Classes were open to all comers, and non-Christians were encouraged to attend the introductory classes in Christianity. Catechumens, converts who had not yet been baptized, studied alongside students of Greek philosophy, as well as ordained priests. Many of the students came from abroad, especially from Rome, and graduates from the school held prominent positions throughout the empire. Classes were held in Greek and the more everyday language of Coptic, and by the 4th century even blind students could study there using a system of raised writing on wooden boards, which predated Braille by 15 centuries. So education at the Didascalia under Clement's tutelage was truly eclectic, which fitted precisely with his own highly educated and open-minded personality and philosophy. The philosophy he taught was not to be the Stoic, nor the Platonic, nor the Epicurean, nor that of Aristotle, but whatever any of these sects had said that was fit and just, that taught righteousness with a divine and religious knowledge, this I call mixed philosophy. Like Celsus, Clement was a universalist. He believed that all humanity could be united under one religion, and thus all would be saved from damnation. But unlike Celsus, for Clement that universal religion would be Christianity, not Platonism. Under his guidance, Alexandrian Christians brought intellectual rigor to its doctrines and adapted it to all classes of people, and in so doing they attempted to proclaim a world philosophy capable of being understood by all and sundry, from the highest to the lowest, from kings and emperors to slaves, women and children. It was Clement's great genius, and a mark of his devout Christian faith, that in the face of Celsus's withering attack he turned the other cheek, and sought to incorporate all that seemed good and of value in Celsus's Hellenistic philosophy into his own Christian doctrine. The key to Clement's plans for the Didascalia was the same as the key to the Platonists' museum: writing. As Clement himself noted, he became a Christian at a time when most Christian teaching and thought was oral, handed down from the apostles to their followers and their followers' children. Yet Clement was a highly literate scholar in the true Alexandrian tradition, and felt it was his duty to attempt to make a written record of the original oral tradition. By this time, most of the New Testament had been written down, but nobody had employed the Alexandrian approach to Christianity. That is, to collect everything ever written on the relevant subject, refine it, subject it to scientific analysis, and finally incorporate it into a way of living and being, a Christian form of Celsus's right living. This is what Clement determined to do, to beat the Alexandrian philosophers at their own game, as it were. Clement divided his great work into three parts. Some scholars equate this with the three degrees of the Neoplatonic mysteries, purification, initiation, and vision. Others see it more directly as a graduated initiation into Christian life as belief, discipline, and knowledge, or perhaps even more sublimely as reflecting the Holy Trinity of Son, Father, and Holy Ghost. More overtly, the first set of books, titled The Exhortation to the Heathen, or more briefly, the Potrepticus, or Exhortation, aims to win pagans to the Christian faith. The second set, the Pedagogus, or Instructor, sets out to teach the convert how to live a proper Christian life. The third part's full title is Titus Flavius Clement's Miscellaneous Collection of Speculative Gnostic Notes Bearing Upon the True Philosophy. It has come to be known as the Stromata, or Tapestries, and aims to provide the raw materials from a huge range of sources from which the trained disciple can gain a higher knowledge of the Christian mystery. It is perhaps the boldest literary undertaking in the history of the Church, and certainly the largest and most valuable record of early Christian thought to have come down to us. Together, then, these form their own curriculum, a Christian version of Philo's Encyclia. So what would the young catechumen or pagan philosopher have heard in the halls of the Didascalia? In the first book, The Exhortation, Clement invites the reader to listen not to the pagan legends of the gods, but to the new song of the Logos, the Word of God, the Creator of the world. He points to the folly of idolatry and pagan mysticism and the horrors of pagan sacrifice. He also identifies what he sees as the weakness of pagan philosophy, which has only guessed at the real truth, while the divine Logos, as personified by Christ, has revealed the nature of truth, the living Word of God in person, requiring only that his teaching be followed, in order to awaken all that is good in the human soul and lead it toward immortality. In the second book, The Instructor, Clement establishes Christ as the divine instructor and sets out in painstaking detail exactly how a Christian, one who has been rescued from the darkness and pollutions of heathenism, should live a good and virtuous life. In this book, divided into 12 chapters, he addresses the minutiae of conduct under the following headings: on eating, on drinking, on costly vessels, how to conduct ourselves at feasts, on laughter, on filthy speaking, directions for those who live together, on the use of ointments and crowns, on sleep, on clothes, on shoes, against excessive fondness for jewels and gold ornaments. Each one of these chapters runs to several pages, giving a complete history of the usage of the subject under discussion, as well as the views expressed both in the scriptures and in secular and philosophical writing, as well as Clement's own advice on how a good Christian should treat the subject. On drinking, for example, such as he would have witnessed in the festivals of Dionysus and the private banqueting clubs once frequented by Philo, he sounds a note of caution. "Use a little wine," says the apostle to Timothy, who drank water, "for thy stomach's sake," most properly applying its aid as a strengthening tonic suitable to a sickly body enfeebled with watery humours, and specifying a little, lest the remedy should, on account of its quantity, unobserved, create the necessity of other treatment. Clement of Alexandria, Instructor. He does not condemn drinking alcohol outright, however. He takes the opportunity to explain the Holy Communion, in which Christians drank wine mixed with water in imitation of the Last Supper, when Christ told the apostles that it was his blood, and they should drink in remembrance of him. "For the blood of the grape, that is, the Word, desired to be mixed with water, as his blood is mixed with salvation. Accordingly, as wine is blended with water, so is the Spirit with man. And the one, the mixture of wine and water, nourishes to faith, while the other, the Spirit, conducts to immortality, and the mixture of both, of the water and of the word, is called Eucharist. Clement of Alexandria, Instructor. This is followed by a long discussion of the merits of wine as well as the demerits of excess. Moderation in all things is a major part of Clement's message. Typically of Clement, however, much of his message would have appealed just as much to Celsus as it did to his Christian converts. For him there was a place for the educated Alexandrian philosopher in Christianity, just as there was for the street peddler, and he appealed to their Platonic belief in right living to attract them. On the subject of choosing a bed, for instance, he uses language that could have come from any of those pagan or Jewish intellectuals trained in the Encyclia. The bed which we use must be simple and frugal and so constructed that, by avoiding the extremes of too much indulgence and too much endurance, it may be comfortable. But let not the couch be elaborate, and let it have smooth feet, for elaborate turnings form occasionally paths for creeping things which twine themselves about the incisions of the work and do not slip off. Clement of Alexandria, Instructor. Of course, Clement was considerably more ambitious than proponents of the great chain of being in believing that there was a place for everyone in his philosophy. While Philo considered that a woman's place was in the home, and even secluded within that, Clement suggested that women too could be a part of his great project, provided that they also turned away from the more material aspects of Alexandrian life and adorned themselves not with gold, but with the Word of God. Having exhorted the heathen to turn to Christ and set out how they should live, Clement then moved on to his third work. The Stromata, or Tapestries, is aimed at the mature Christian believer who by studying the work will be able to perfect his or her Christian life by initiation into complete knowledge of both man and God. It means to give an account of the Christian faith which will answer the questions of all men, even the pagan cynics who inhabit the museum in Alexandria, not through logical arguments, but rather by building up a tapestry of spiritually nourishing thoughts of his own, drawn from the scriptures, and, indeed, even from the pagan world around him. He had no intention of sticking to an ordered plan for the work, declaring that his intention was to create a work like a meadow, where all varieties of flowers grow at random, or like a hillside planted with every possible variety of tree. In this way, Clement aimed to reveal the innermost realities of his beliefs. His original intention was to do this in one book, but it steadily mushroomed into seven or possibly eight books, though if the eighth book ever existed, it is now lost. Eusebius's speculation that the final book was composed solely of extracts taken from pagan philosophers might explain why it has not survived. While the cornerstone of this work, like all the others, is the revelation and promotion of faith, and the assertion that such revelation is superior to philosophy, he does still have an eye toward the scholars of the museum. He insists that God's truth is to be found both in revelation and in philosophy. He opens the fifth chapter of the work with a section entitled Philosophy, the Handmaiden of Theology. Accordingly, before the advent of the Lord, philosophy was necessary to the Greeks for righteousness, and now it becomes conducive to piety, being a kind of preparatory training to those who attain faith through demonstration. Philosophy, therefore, was a preparation, paving the way for him who is perfected in Christ. Clement of Alexandria, Stromata. Clement taught in Alexandria from 190 until 202, numbering among his pupils the same Origen who would later be called upon to write the rebuttal to Celsus's pagan broadside, and who would succeed him as dean of the Didascalia. But if Christianity was finding a place in Alexandria, it could still be considered a dangerous and seditious sect in Rome. It challenged Roman authority. It refused to acknowledge the divinity of the emperor and preached that the meek and not the imperial family were the inheritors of the earth. Anti-Christian purges, just like the frequent anti-Jewish pogroms, remained common, and the Alexandrian mob, which had been so easily roused against Philo's friends, was just as adeptly turned against Clement's. In 202, the emperor Septimius Severus, a North African himself, ordered a purge of the Alexandrian Christians. In the ensuing persecution, the 17-year-old Origen saw his father martyred, engendering in him a lifelong hatred for the Romans. Clement fled the city and took shelter in Palestine. From there he travelled to Antioch to stay with his star pupil Alexander, by then archbishop of the city, who reported his master's death in a letter to Origen in 215. Clement's flight proved to be a decisive moment in the history of early Christianity and the history of his home city of Alexandria. As a scholar of the city, he had attempted to bridge the gap between Christian, Jew, and pagan with a hopefulness and generosity which might eventually have drawn these disparate groups together. As the church historian F. W. Farrar once said, Alexandria was in its time the cradle of Christian theology, but the early life of the child born in that cradle would prove violent and bloody enough to turn many church fathers away from Clement's liberal views. A church born into purges and persecutions found his message too Hellenistic, too open to other philosophies, to the point where, some 1500 years after his death, Pope Benedict XIV would have his name removed entirely from the church calendar. A unique moment when the old pagan and Jewish city and the new Christian one might have come together to set a new path, a new interpretation of the work the museum had striven for so many centuries to achieve, had been wasted. Instead, the seeds of a bitter and ultimately deadly struggle that would tear up the very roads and colonnades of the city itself were sown in their place. Imperial Rome and Christianity were on a collision course. If the infant religion was to survive, it would have to learn to fight even before it had learned to walk. Words were all well and good, but they had not safeguarded Clement in his city. His pupil Origen and the young catechumens had seen just how little the masters of the world cared for philosophy. If Rome wanted a fight, they could have it. Chapter 15. Into the Soft Machine. Our body is a machine for living. It is organized for that. It is its nature. Leo Tolstoy, War and Peace. While the talk in the markets and shops of Alexandria was now more often than not centered on the subject of religion, that was not yet the overriding consideration for either the provincial government or the museum. Rome had more serious worries than the growth of Christianity that were even now pressing on her borders. The second half of the second century saw the emergence of a new threat to the Roman world order, not from within, but from without. The barbarian German tribes, along with their Sarmatian allies, were massing along the northeastern frontiers of the empire, along the east banks of the Danube and Rhine, and threatening to flood into the empire itself. It is an irony of history that the first emperor who tried to contain the threat was also one of its most sophisticated intellectuals, a man better suited to the museum and library in Alexandria than to the wilds of his empire's frontiers. Marcus Aurelius, ruled 161-80, was also known as Marcus Aurelius Antoninus the Philosopher, and the collection of imperial biographies known as the Historia Augusta says that Plato's judgment was always on his lips, that states flourished if philosophers ruled or rulers were philosophers. Sadly for this frail and thoughtful emperor, his rule would seem to prove otherwise. On his accession, Marcus Aurelius had immediately taken his adoptive brother Lucius Verus into the emperorship with him, for the first time splitting the primary role in the empire between two people. It was a move born out of pity, more than practicality, granting the man who had always been in his shadow an equal position that, unfortunately, he was unequal to. The timing also could not have been worse. At the very moment the two men were taking the imperial throne, hostilities were already breaking out on the British frontier along Hadrian's Wall and along the Danube, while in the east the Parthians had seized the province of Armenia, destroying two whole Roman legions in the process. For the first time the empire appeared vulnerable, and Alexandrians, despite their chafing against Roman rule, must have prayed that their occupiers would prove up to the task of keeping the barbarians outside their protected, and as they saw it, civilized world. Marcus Aurelius, for all his love of philosophy, could still prove a man of action. While choosing to tackle the Danube problem himself, he sent the dithering and indulgent Verus to deal with Parthia, along with his best general, Avidius Cassius. Avidius was also from an academic family, his father having been a rhetorician in Syria, But under Verus's nominal command he fortunately showed himself also to be a great soldier, restoring peace in the East. For this he was rewarded with supreme command over the entire region, including Egypt, the same post Mark Antony had held before him. And it was perhaps this unfortunate precedent that then began to work on his mind. Verus, for his part, returned west with a less welcome trophy, soldiers infected by a plague which then swept the ancient world. At the same moment, the barbarians beyond the Danube finally broke out and swarmed into the empire, reaching Italy itself. In a mad scramble, Marcus Aurelius recruited 2 new legions and saved the situation, eventually agreeing to peace terms and managing to take back Italy. On his triumphant return to Rome, his co-emperor Verus died of apoplexy in 169, removing at least one threat to Marcus Aurelius's rule. But the impenetrable facade of imperial might had been breached, and Egypt itself was encouraged to revolt. When Avidius Cassius quickly suppressed the rebellion, Marcus Aurelius must have believed he had finally found an ally he could trust. He was very wrong. Avidius Cassius's experience of imperial rule in the form of an ineffectual co-emperor had given him unusual ambition. Now, as virtual ruler of the East, the inheritor of Mark Antony's mantle, and perhaps seduced by his dream, he struck. Hearing that Marcus Aurelius had been killed on the northern frontier, or at least claiming that to be the case, he proclaimed himself emperor, possibly encouraged in this by Marcus Aurelius's own wife, Faustina. Faustina had long despaired of her husband's frequent bouts of ill health, something which in these turbulent times she knew could have direct effects on her and her children. If her husband suddenly died, there was no one to guarantee her safety, and any new imperial candidate would almost certainly begin his campaign to gain legitimacy by killing the true heirs, her children. Perhaps in Avidius she found a guarantor for her children, or at least saw the opportunity to force the hand of history. Whether Avidius knew he was bluffing when he announced the emperor's death is uncertain, although the Historia Augusta is suspicious. Nevertheless, Avidius evidently persuaded several senior officials to back his claim to the laurels, and among these was the governor of Alexandria, Lucius Misianus, who had once been Marcus Aurelius's tutor, and who may have had ambitions of joint sovereignty with Avidius. Egypt and Alexandria stood once again on the brink of king-making, but once again it would prove a false dawn. Marcus Aurelius was not dead. Indeed, he was marching back toward Rome, and from there he would perhaps sail across the Mediterranean to Egypt. Certainly the spectre of this was enough to unnerve Avidius's soldiers, and his 3-month-old empire dissolved as quickly as it had appeared. Fearing the emperor's retribution, one of Avidius's own centurions turned on him and stabbed him to death. The assassination of the governor of Alexandria was not far behind. It was with some trepidation then that the people of Alexandria turned out to greet their emperor when he arrived in their city in the winter of 176. No place had been more closely connected with the usurper, and the emperor could hardly be expected to leave the city unscathed. Julius Caesar had burnt the city, and very possibly the precious library, when he had arrived to remove the upstart Mark Antony, and many must have feared a reprise. But Marcus Aurelius did nothing. Certainly he shed some crocodile tears for the dead Avidius, just as Caesar had wept for the murdered Pompey, protesting that he would have spared his life if only he had reached Egypt in time. The Historia Augusta says that on receiving Avidius's head, the emperor did not rejoice or exult, but rather was grieved that he had lost an opportunity for showing mercy. For he said that he had wished to take him alive, so that he might reproach him with the kindness he had shown him in the past, and then spare his life. Anonymous. Historia Augusta. It was, of course, a story Alexandrians had heard before, but provided he chose to play the victorious Octavian rather than the vengeful Caesar, they were happy to go along. And Marcus Aurelius had no desire to harm such a spiritual homeland. So instead of a bloodbath, the citizens of Alexandria enjoyed the company of their philosopher emperor, and he in turn took delight in the open and vibrant civic life of the city, as well as the intellectual life of the museum and library. If the emperor needed a reason to preserve Alexandria, He had only to walk through the gardens and lecture halls in the museum to find it, for this institution was still the training ground for some of the greatest minds in antiquity. One of those who had benefited from an education here was his personal physician, and the greatest doctor in the Roman world, Galen. Galen was born in Alexandria's great rival city of Pergamum, around 129, about a century and a half after Mark Antony had bequeathed the city's 200,000-volume library to his lover Cleopatra. Despite this loss, the city had thrived, and become particularly famous for its temple and sanctuary of Asclepius, the Greek god of healing, where people from across the empire came to seek cures both through prayer and through the ministrations of the doctors who gathered there. Galen's father, Nikon, had been a successful and affluent architect, and he had given his son a broad classical education in mathematics, logic, grammar, and philosophy, embracing all four major schools, those of Plato and Aristotle, as well as Stoicism and Epicureanism. But it was to medicine that young Galen turned when he was just 16. According to legend, after his father had a dream revealing the youth's destiny in the subject. In years to come, as Galen went on to become the greatest doctor in the Roman world, many of his patients must have thought that the dream had been sent by Asclepius himself. Galen began his studies at the Asclepian shrine in Pergamum before travelling on to study under other masters in Smyrna, now Izmir in Turkey, then in Corinth, before finally reaching the great medical school at Alexandria in 152. Alexandria was still the obvious place to finish an education in medicine in the second century, not simply because of its great heritage of physicians and anatomists, but because in Alexandria, thanks to its Egyptian heritage, it was still possible to do there what could not be done elsewhere, dissect the human body. Such procedures were still taboo across most of the empire, and without a chance to look inside the body, most doctors were forced to rely on outward symptoms both to identify and to cure an ill. But here, Galen tells us, you could look at the human skeleton with your own eyes. This is very easy in Alexandria, so that the physicians of that area instruct their pupils with the aid of autopsy. These experiences gave Galen a passion for dissection, which would both make and, many centuries later, break his reputation. By opening human bodies, both living and dead, he was able to view the body as a machine, like one of Hero's automatons, and brilliantly deduce its functions. In his later career, he would repeat his investigations on animals in front of astounded crowds, while he challenged the other doctors of the empire to disagree with his findings. A particularly famous experiment involved a rather gruesome operation on a live pig. Cutting an incision down its back, he would slowly sever groups of spinal nerves to show their function. Of course, all the while the pig would squeal, until he tied off the laryngeal nerve and the pig suddenly stopped. And so he proceeded, removing or tying off various vital pathways and identifying their purpose from the effect. He tied off animals' ureters to demonstrate kidney and bladder function, and closed off veins and arteries to prove that, contrary to the popular theory of the day, they carried blood and not air. On the basis of remarks made in Plato's Laws, it seems that prior to Galen, the medical system in the Hellenistic world was two-tiered. Physicians for the wealthy treated their patients in accordance with theoretical principles. They were known as dogmatists. Physicians for slaves relied upon trial and error, and were known as empiricists. Detractors claimed that the dogmatists honored theory above observation and experience. Between these two extremes were the Methodists, whose sole concern was the disease itself, ignoring the patient, his or her medical history, and so on. Galen claimed to belong to none of these schools, though we know that he was certainly educated in the dogmatic school and practiced both empirically and methodically. He recognized that it was necessary both to develop theories from practical observation and experience, and to test existing theory against observations, modifying or abandoning it if it seemed not to work. Much of Galen's theory was based on the teachings of Hippocrates, the Greek father of medicine. Hippocrates held that the human body was controlled by four humours, phlegm, blood, black bile, and yellow bile. Each humour was also related to parts of the body, head, phlegm, heart, blood, liver, black bile, and gallbladder, yellow bile. Imbalance in these four basic humours caused illness, and it was the job of the physician to right this balance. From Plato, Galen also employed the four-element theory, earth, air, water, fire, and the theory of contraries, hot, cold, wet, dry. Like the four elements, humours were characterised by two qualities. The earth was considered the heaviest of elements, and black bile, with its coldness and dryness, was seen as the heaviest of the humours, an excess of which caused melancholy. Blood, like air, had the qualities of heat and moisture. Phlegm, like water, had coldness and moisture. And yellow bile, like fire, had heat and dryness. He then formulated an almost quantitative scale of admixture of such things, which he wrote up in a book called On Mixtures. So if a person was suffering from a cold, wet condition, such as a chest infection, he should be treated with a hot and dry drug, such as certain moulds and fungi, penicillin perhaps. While Western medicine may have moved away from such elemental concepts, we should note that much Indian and Chinese medicine has not, what Galen was doing was making the task of diagnosis and treatment multidimensional, looking at both the illness and the cure from multiple perspectives. He himself acknowledged his eclectic, pluralistic approach, and this is perhaps Galen's most enduring contribution to the history of medicine. Inspired by this theoretical grounding and the anatomical mysteries he witnessed in Alexandria, Galen returned to his native Pergamum to begin his medical practice. Pergamum would prove a difficult place for him to work, however, as it did not allow its doctors to dissect human bodies. Fortunately, an official appointment came up that suited him perfectly, as physician to the gladiators. Gladiatorial combat was a standard entertainment in the Roman world, and was not always the deadly spectacle it is imagined to be. Gladiators were the football superstars of their day, the subject of adulatory graffiti in public baths, and the pin-ups of young girls everywhere. A good gladiator, although a slave, was worth a fortune to his owner, and hoped to win one day the wooden sword that would mark his retirement and freedom. So he would be attended on by the best physicians his master could afford, the sports physiotherapists of their day, whose job it was to keep the gladiator healthy and fighting. Although Galen could not dissect criminals or corpses, he could use the skills he had learned in the Alexandrian anatomy theatres to cure the gladiator's often horrific wounds. Provided it was a gladiator who made the incision in the arena and not a doctor on the operating table, no one complained if he then used these wounds, or windows onto anatomy as he called them, to explore the inner workings of the body. At the same time, he also pioneered the treatment of the more usual sports injuries, sprains, breaks, dislocations, and concussions. From these he developed 130 of the 150 basic surgical techniques that are still in use today. Everything from brain surgery to repairing compressed fractures to the use of traction beds to straighten broken limbs. Even at the end of a gladiator's career, there was one last procedure that Galen developed that would assist his patient in his new life as a free man, the removal of the tattoo that marked him as a slave. It was not long before it became clear that Pergamum was too small a world for such a great doctor, and 5 years after his return there from Alexandria, he moved to Rome. Here he found medicine in a similarly primitive state, held back by its taboos against Alexandrian anatomy. The Roman poet Martial noted ironically, "Until recently, Diolus was a doctor. Now he is an undertaker. He is still doing as an undertaker what he used to do as a doctor." Not surprisingly, then, this new doctor from the East dazzled the court, and as a superb self-publicist, Galen took every opportunity to put his rivals in the shade. One such occasion was provided by the arrival of a Persian merchant, complaining of a loss of feeling in the ring and little fingers and half the middle finger of one hand. For some time, Roman doctors had been applying unguents and creams to the fingers in the hope of stimulating them, but to no effect. Galen asked him an unusual question. Had he hurt his arm recently? The question must have been quite surprising. The man's problem was clearly in his fingers. What did that have to do with his arm? But Galen was right. The man said he had taken a bad fall and hurt his back. Galen diagnosed a spinal lesion and recommended bed rest and soothing compresses for the injury site. It worked, and the man's fingers recovered. It may sound like a small thing, numb fingers, but in curing them, Galen was laying the foundations of modern neurology. Such demonstrations made Galen famous, while his arrogance, his outspoken attacks on his detractors, and his withering humiliation of less successful doctors made him many enemies. Galen was not a modest man, and in later life he would happily compare himself to a Roman emperor. "I have done as much for medicine as the Emperor Trajan did for the Roman Empire when he built bridges and roads through Italy. It is I, and I alone, who have revealed the true path of medicine."
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.